This is Focus with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
It is unusual these days to focus on this particular issue. But what we're talking about today could end life on Earth. It's not climate change. It's nuclear technology, and in particular, nuclear weapons. On this Earth, nine nations are armed with nuclear bombs, and those weapons do pose an existential threat to life on Earth. Today on Focus, you'll hear from one of the world's foremost anti-nuclear activists, and from a woman who has dedicated a fair portion of her adult life to finding out what actually happened when the British were testing nuclear bombs in Australia in the 50s and 60s. Her discoveries are shocking, the effects are still being felt, and there are still secrets sitting in filing cabinets in Britain about what happened on Australian soil that she is trying to uncover. Had this conversation first at the Brisbane Writers Festival earlier this month, so if, as you're listening, you're shocked and appalled, like I was, then text 0467 922 612 or email the Focus team, focusbrisbane@abc.net.au. And if you need to get in and out of the car today and you don't want to miss a thing, then you can download the ABC Listen app and listen to it in your headphones as you get about your business.
Focus with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
Dr. Helen Caldicott is a doctor, an activist, author and editor, and she's been advocating against nuclear weapons since at least 1971, when the French were testing them in the Pacific. She's been a force behind professional doctors' groups that oppose nuclear technology, and she's written or edited several books on the subject, most recently Sleepwalking to Armageddon. Dr. Elizabeth Tynan is an associate professor at James Cook Uni, and her book, Atomic Thunder, The Maralinga Story, last year won the Prime Minister's Literary Prize for a book on Australian history. And it is a must read, as far as I'm concerned. What it unveils about Australian history is shocking. Now, I started this chat at the Brisbane Writers' Festival by asking Helen Caldicott whether she agreed the threat of nuclear weapons was not really top of mind these days.
Yes, they were during the 80s, when we had 80% of Americans opposed to nuclear weapons. We had 1 million people in Central Park. I met with Reagan for an hour and a quarter trying to teach him about nuclear weapons, which was fairly difficult.
Why?
I said, you probably don't know who I am, do you? He said, yes, you're an Australian. You read On the Beach and you're scared of nuclear war. And I said, yes. And he said, well, I too am scared of nuclear war, but our ways to prevent it differ. I believe in building more bombs. So we're off to a flying start. And I'd just written Missile Envy, a la Freud, and I was absolutely full of facts and figures. You get that, don't you? I mean, the missile goes up and the big balls of fire at the bottom. And the
Do you
generals,
know what she's referring to there?
The generals all hated it, but they had a copy on their bookshelves. Anyway, so Reagan would say a few things and he was wrong, so I'd stop him and correct him. And when
would
I
you
did...
you say, you are wrong, Mr. President?
Yeah, I'd say, you're wrong. This is the fact, you know, and he'd get a red flush on his cheek because he got really anxious. So I ended up half the time holding his hand, developing a doctor-patient relationship with him. He's a nice old man. He would have been a good farmer or, you know, digging fence posts or something. I didn't think I'd had any influence at all. And I came out saying I thought he had impending Alzheimer's, which he did. That was a correct diagnosis. I thought I'd had no influence, but he started to say nuclear war must never be fought and can never be won. And he started working with Gorbachev, but mostly because Physicians for Social Responsibility had taught the American people via the media what happens if a bomb drops on Boston and how people are vaporized and turned into gas and huge fires and the like. We really impacted the whole of American society.
So what's happened in 30 years then, Helen, that we've gone from such awareness to it not being top of mind?
Well, what happened was that we ended the Cold War and Gorbachev, what a wonderful man. And Reagan ended the Cold War, and we thought, oh, thank God, you know. We were so tired. I'd go to three cities a day speaking. Then they talked about the peace dividend and putting money into roads and schools and healthcare. And then the corporations, Lockheed Martin, which is now in our universities, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Boeing, all making nuclear weapons and missiles, they got going behind the scenes. And the head of Lockheed Martin went to all the newly released European countries from the Soviet Union, who Gorbachev asked America not to enlarge NATO. But he went to all the little countries, Lithuania and Latvia, and said, do you want to be a democracy? And they said yes, but join NATO. To join NATO, they had to buy $3 billion worth of weapons or something. So they enlarged NATO right up to the Russian border. But people don't know that, and they kept making nuclear weapons.
So it was like a corporatization of the Cold War?
Yeah. Well, the Cold War was always about the corporations in a way, but now it's major big time, and Americans spend most of their money in killing.
Would you agree with it that it's not top of mind as well, Elizabeth?
Yes, I don't know as much about the contemporary situation as Helen does, obviously, but I think certainly climate change has become the existential threat du jour. But I do know that nuclear weapons have never gone away since they were first invented, and there are some countries that are actively building their arsenals.
Yeah, but America's going to rebuild every single weapon, missile, ship over the next 30 years to the tune of $1.7 billion. I mean, and there's Trump, who has the football, which are the codes to start a nuclear war, and he gets 3 minutes decision time. He's now backed up against the wall. He's paranoid. Etc. I don't really know how we're still here. We've had so many close calls.
I wake up in the morning
and look at my roses and think, well, they're still here. And
look at the roses.
I tell you, it's as close as that. And it means all life on Earth. The only life in the universe, possibly, and we're taking no notice.
I do want to get into what is the current threat level, lots of developments, even since the book came out, Sleepwalking to Armageddon, that you have edited, where there's lots of situations around the world that could be flashpoints for this. So we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But Elizabeth, with your book, Atomic Thunder, looking at the Maralinga tests of 70-odd years ago...
Just over 60. Yes.
Mm. This takes you into some really dirty, hidden crevices of Australian history. How did you get in there?
Oh, well, yes. I'm a bit of an archives nerd, and there's nothing I love more than to get a dusty old file that is stamped top secret atomic. That's my nirvana. And so I have just gone to the archives in both Australia and the United Kingdom. In fact, I've just returned from another trip to the United Kingdom where I not only went to the UK archives in Kew, which is the most amazing place, but also to the Churchill Archive at Cambridge and to several different archives at Oxford. And I just spend... it feels like 5 minutes, but it's generally a whole day, going through and looking at the documents that relate to the British nuclear tests. So that's what I started doing for my PhD, and I continued with the book, and now I'm working on another one. And so, yes, I don't base my work on interviews. I don't interview veterans. I don't interview people who are involved. Prefer might be the wrong word. I find it very helpful to go to the original documents. So
and
that's where I go.
How many of those folders labelled top secret atomic have you actually delved into?
I've lost count. There are so many. But unfortunately, the British, and this may surprise or not, people, the British, even all these years later, keep a lot of those secrets still. So when I find a file listed at the British Archives or in the archival system, quite often when I go to order it, it has been retained by the Ministry of Defence. Now, I think personally, and I think Helen agrees, that that is outrageous, that these were tests done on Australian soil. The tests that I'm particularly looking at the moment were extremely dangerous. And yet a lot of those records are actually not open. So I'm doing what I can to open the records.
What are you doing?
Well, at the moment, the archives in Britain are pretty well organised, and you can make a Freedom of Information request through the archives. And so that's what I'm doing at the moment. But I've also formed I've been introduced to a journalist, an investigative journalist over there who may be able to help me as well. He has worked in this area. So I think it's probably going to be impossible for me to get at the very heart of the nuclear data that I really want to get to. I don't know that the British are ever going to give that up. But I have found ways in to the information through, you know, I mentioned going to the archives at Oxford, for example. These are more obscure archives, and they relate to Lord Chirwell, for example, who was a fellow called Lindemann, who was a scientific advisor to Churchill, who was a major mover and shaker, and he appears in my book as the grey eminence of the British nuclear test series. So I've got into his archive, and I had an absolutely amazing time in that archive, but also to Lord Portal's archive, and he ran the program to create not only the nuclear weapons in Britain in the late 40s, but also nuclear energy. So I'm trying to get at the records in different ways, not just the Ministry of Defence type stuff. I'm probably never going to get, you know, the really hardcore scientific data, but I find other ways to get the information that I need. And it's detective work. We were saying this before. Yeah. It's like being a detective. Yeah. And I'm looking for the smoking warhead, so to speak.
Well, hopefully it's, you know, not being let off. But what a tremendous public service you are doing here, Elizabeth Tynan, as well. And, I mean, hearing Elizabeth say that she's had an amazing time with, you know, that particular file, and she's an archives nerd, I've just got a picture in my head of you, I don't know, wearing party gear with a glass of champagne.
The archives in the UK is like Fort Knox, and it's extremely restrictive, and you go through several layers of security to get in there, and you have to be registered to be a reader. And then when you're in there, it's all terribly silent, terribly grim. But there are times when I would love to have a party balloon and, you know, and streamers, because I've found something, you know, and I have to be oh so very restrained. But inside, I'm going internally berserk. So, yes.
Well, high five right high now. Five. Go, Elizabeth Tynan. Many of us would not know the first thing about those tests that occurred on Australian soil those decades ago. If you could steal one of the headlines from tomorrow's newspaper or the lead story on the ABC News tonight with information that you've uncovered, what would it be?
British trash South Australia. as you probably, if you've read the book, you'll know that at least some of the Buffalo series in 1956, some of the nuclear cloud went over Adelaide. And I was talking to Helen about this yesterday, that what we actually need is an epidemiological study of people who lived in Adelaide at that time. Now, my family were in Adelaide. I wasn't born then, but I would love to see that study. And I think you're right. We need to get at the medical side of it, which has never really been delved into, certainly in Australia. There has been a study of the British nuclear veterans, an epidemiological study, which was rather inconclusive. It is actually quite hard to draw a causal link between exposure to radiation and later illness. That has always been a problem. And anyone who's ever looked at the Royal Commission held in the mid-80s will know that it is actually Jim McClellan, Diamond Jim, who ran the Royal Commission, tried very hard to draw that causal link. But he didn't have possession of all the knowledge
either.
Yeah, but
we have the Hedley Marston data. Now, he was a scientist at the Medical Institute of Med and Vet Science in Adelaide. And he took the thyroids of sheep, and he analysed them and found they were chock-a-block full of radioactive iodine.
When did he do that?
just contemporary after, with the test.
Yes, just yeah, after a terrible test, which blew all of that fallout over Adelaide. And the people were not informed, but if there's radioactive iodine, there are 200 other isotopes, strontium, cesium, you name it, americium, plutonium. And he, the Atomic Energy Commission, prevented him from publishing his paper for 4 years. But what happens to sheep happens to us. And I was an intern sometime at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, sometime after that, and I can remember a lovely ballerina who was 30, beautiful girl who came in with thyroid cancer and died. And I remember thinking, I wonder if that's what caused it. And also, I've got a multinodular goitre, so does my brother. And I'm sure, I mean, they never did an epidemiological study of patients in cancer. Of cancer. It means you've got nodules in your thyroid which are not malignant per se at the time, but could develop malignancy.
Most of you will remember, if you're old enough, the school milk program, and I certainly do. I hated it, and I hate milk to this day. Yeah. But they found radioactivity from the British tests in the school milk program. So children at that time who have smaller bodies, smaller mass,
they're 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults.
And where did they find that? Was that in Adelaide?
They found it in Adelaide, but they found it in other places as well. And I can tell you, I now live in Townsville. They found radioactive iodine in cows in Townsville from the British tests.
Yep.
Yes. So so the clouds were out of control. Just think back to the 50s. There were no satellites. We did not have weather satellites. We didn't understand how to predict the weather. Even today, it's a dark art. It's still not certain. But they had virtually no means of predicting the weather back then. And so the clouds of nuclear particles were... Once they were released, that was it. They didn't really know.
You should talk about the plutonium.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to talk about the plutonium, but...
Okay, let's talk about the plutonium.
Well, I should say as a doctor what plutonium really is.
Yes,
it's got a half-life of 24,400 years, and you'll multiply that by 10 to get its total radiological life. It's almost the most toxic substance on Earth, as Glenn Seaborg, who discovered it, called it
that. He invented it,
It emits alpha particles, which are tiny little particles.
Is it naturally occurring?
No, we made it.
It's artificial.
Yeah.
Created in the 40s.
We're very clever.
Mm.
But that's the fuel for nuclear weapons and hydrogen bombs, you see.
That's plutonium-239, which is the... It's at the heart of most nuclear weapons. Now, you think back to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was actually a uranium device. It was a more primitive device. But the one dropped on Nagasaki was a plutonium device.
Yeah.
And plutonium is much, much more efficient at creating a bomb than uranium.
So let me just talk about the medical implications. So if you inhale a millionth of a gram of plutonium into your lung... that can cause lung cancer. And you can extrapolate and say 1 pound of plutonium or half a kilo would be enough to give everyone on Earth cancer. When it's inhaled into the lung, it gets transferred to the mediastinal lymph glands in the centre of the chest by macrophages that grab it and take it over. And then it gets solubilised. And the body thinks it's iron, so it combines with transferrin, the iron-transporting protein, where it's stored in the bone marrow to form hemoglobin. The liver, where iron goes, but also it crosses the placenta. Now, placenta lets nothing past, but it lets plutonium. Now, plutonium, therefore, can get into developing fetus and kill a cell that's going to form the right arm or the left half of the brain. That's what thalidomide did. It's called teratogenesis. So it's a potent cancer-forming substance. It creates mutations in the eggs and the sperm of future generations. And it's the most deadly substance on Earth, which is also used to make nuclear weapons, which could destroy life on Earth.
And the thing about Maralinga too and plutonium is they didn't just test plutonium-based devices, the warheads themselves. They also did tests which were radiological tests, particularly Vixen B, where they blew a warhead up using conventional explosive.
Yeah.
And this did not create a nuclear reaction, but it just made plutonium into particles and spread it through. It fell to Earth. It was in the dust. Now, the British, when they left, told the Australians that 22 kilograms of it had been safely stored in pits, and that left 2 kilograms on the loose, which is bad enough. But in fact, it was the other way around, that 20 kilograms was loose on the range.
And Elizabeth,
and dust storms blow from there, yeah, all over the place.
Yeah.
So, Elizabeth, are there any deaths that are directly attributable to the Maralinga, the Vixen B tests, the Buffalo tests?
I can't give you a definitive answer on that, and I wish I could, but for one thing, I'm not a physician like Helen, but also the evidence is very unclear. But I do know anecdotally that there is an extraordinary incidence of blood cancers, and I've personally met some of the veterans, including a fellow in Townsville who had terrible neck cancers, and he also had a disabled daughter born after the tests, and he speculated that that was part of that. He died fairly recently of his cancers. I don't myself get too much into, you know, the causal links, because I know that they're very difficult.
Did he believe that he was,
yes,
ill because of it?
He fought for years to get the gold card, and which is, you know, unlimited health care in Australia. As some of you will know, it's only a year ago that the gold card was granted to nuclear veterans and Indigenous people in Australia. They left it a long time, didn't they? There are not that many left now.
Focus with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
And it's 26 minutes past 10 on ABC Radio Brisbane. This conversation with author Elizabeth Tynan and Dr. Helen Caldicott, an anti-nuclear activist and a physician. They were speaking at the Brisbane Writers' Festival earlier this month. And so if you weren't able to get to the Writers' Festival, this is your lucky day to hear this conversation about something we don't talk about that often anymore. You know, it comes up now and then when the issues around North Korea in particular flare up, or Iran, but it is nuclear weapons. If you have any opinions about this in particular, I guess, to share today, the best way to share them is on the text line 0467 922 612, and I'd be really intrigued to hear from you as to what you think of this conversation between these two cracking women. Elizabeth Tynan's book is called Atomic Thunder, The Maralinga Story, and it's won last year the Prime Minister's Literary Prize for a book on Australian history, and it really is quite astonishing what she's uncovered there. More on this conversation now between Elizabeth Tynan and Dr. Helen Caldicott.
A great revelation for me in this book was the way the First Nations people were so absolutely disregarded. And some people would say that was of the time. But has there been any reparation for them?
Oh, it's so pitiful, the so-called reparation. I can't remember what year, early 90s. I think there was a payment of something like, and someone, it's in my book, it was about $10 million. It's almost an insult. But very little in the way of actual reparation. But you know what? The Indigenous people themselves are the ones who inspire me, because they refuse to let this beat them. I've met some of the people from the Maralinga lands. They now run a tourism venture taking people to the Maralinga test site. They are making money out of this. I am so happy about that. Now, I hasten to add that they don't go to the most contaminated parts of the site. They are very fully aware of the risks. So they only go to the old village, which is reasonably safe, and they don't stay very long.
Have you done the tour?
No, I haven't.
I hope they charge a bomb.
Thank you for that dad's joke. Thank you.
Yeah, I know. I'm a mum.
It's probably the most tragic part of the story, I guess, because during the 50s, Aboriginal people were not included in the census. They did not have federal representation for the most part. Their affairs were conducted through the state governments, and at a very minimal level. And the British, when you look at the records, they are not factoring the fact that these test sites are on people's homelands. They don't even think about it. It's not their issue. And I met a British veteran who was indignant about some parts of my book where I criticised what happened. And he said to me, I sat in his living room in Canterbury in the UK, and he said, well, if the Australian government didn't care about the Aboriginal people, why should the British government? And that was exactly the attitude, that the British government actually took their lead from the Australian government. And so they didn't concern themselves with it. And William Penny, the leader of the British Tests in Australia, said at the Royal Commission many years later, I wasn't aware there was a problem. So the Australian government, of course, is culpable in this. The Australian government did virtually nothing. They did have maybe a tiny, minute, a little bit more concern than the British. So they did appoint a fellow called Walter McDougall, who I think is an absolute hero. He was, for a long time, the only person who was looking after the interests of the Aboriginal people, not just at Maralinga, but also Woomera. He actually had 100,000 square kilometres of territory to cover. Eventually, he was given an offsider, Bob McCauley, and between the two of them, and Bob, who was straight out of Sydney Uni, 23-year-old, never been in the bush, he was not even given a vehicle to begin with. So he didn't, you know, he was actually turned out to be a pretty good bloke, and he did his best as well. But really, all that Walter and Bob could do was go and warn people and
warn the First Nations people there.
Yeah, and get them to stay away and try and, you know, deter them from the site. And, of course, military vehicles would be brought in as well to load Indigenous people on, many of whom had never seen a vehicle, let alone travelled in one. Often they suffered terrible car sickness. They were basically just carted down to the Great Australian Bight and dumped there, away from their ancestral homelands and
was
from
there
their totems. They went to a place called Yalitar, and also Ceduna, around that sort of area. There was a mission, or there were several missions. You know, there were Lutheran missions and Methodist missions that were kind of charged with caring for the people. But, you know, I don't really need to say how bad some of those were, you know. And, yeah, it's a very, very terrible story, what happened to the Aboriginal people. And we don't know how many died. I think we can say, and Helen, as a physician, I'm sure you back me up, that we can be sure that people did die because of their exposure. And there's a very famous case, in fact, of a family called the Milputty family. This was highlighted in the Royal Commission, who were trekking through the lands. They'd come from further north, and they were hoping to catch up with family. And they didn't know, they hadn't encountered Walter McDougall, and they camped in the one and only bomb crater at Maralinga. They actually camped by the side, actually not in, because it was actually a very deep crater. So they camped by the side, and they were found the next morning. They'd been there all night, found there the next morning by a patrol of Australian health physics people, and they were tested using a Geiger counter, and the little boy had, his whole hair was filled with radioactivity. The mother, Edie Milputty, was pregnant, but she lost her baby soon after. The whole family, they had their dogs with them. They were shipped off to Yalitar, and the dogs were shot in front of them. It almost seems like, you know, we're going to make sure that you suffer as much as possible. But on the orders of Howard Beale, the Minister for Supply, the dogs were shot. When he found out they hadn't been shot, he issued an order for them to be shot in front of the family. So that's just one of the stories. Diamond Jim took the Royal Commission and sat in the dust of the Maralinga lands, and he spoke to Edie Milputty, who was very brave, and she revealed her story to him. And I think that's one of the most emotional moments of the Royal Commission when you read the transcript.
Much of the testing, particularly the most dangerous, was kept totally secret at the time. Helen, what do you think? Is that sort of secrecy still happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially in America, with the various labs who are still making nuclear weapons and people who are dying as a result of working with these isotopes all over America, there's a lot of secrecy. And you learn about it from the people who were impacted and affected, but there's so much to find out. I read this literature all the time and learn more and more every day. I got to know Bob McNamara, who was in the Oval Office with Jack Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said, Helen, you don't know how close we came to within 3 minutes. And it's all in the hands of just a few men. And we do nothing about it. And then we've got other hot points, India and Pakistan, who really don't like each other, fighting on the border. They're both armed with nuclear weapons. A nuclear war started there would of necessity trigger a global holocaust between Russia and America, because they're all sort of interconnected. And then we've got Israel with 200 hydrogen bombs, which we'll neither confirm nor deny. China, they've only got about 200, and I wouldn't worry about China. But there are a lot of hot spots.
Why wouldn't you worry about China? Lots of people are worried about China.
What are they worried about?
China taking over the world?
Rhubarb.
Rhubarb.
Look, China's built.
That's a nice
China's built a few islands just off the coast of China, and they've got runways and planes. And America's very upset about it.
So is Australia.
But actually, China is a Pacific nation, and America's got no right to think the Pacific belongs to them. In the island of Hawaii, there is a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons which can destroy two-thirds of the world's population. And in Hawaii, there's a huge cross on top of a mountain to remind the Americans what their obligation is towards the human race, not to destroy it. And all I can see is nations arming themselves to the teeth. The main form of international commerce now is weapons, and we're into it up to our necks with that. What, Maurice? What's her name?
Payne.
Yeah,
no,
Payne.
No, who's it? Christopher Pine.
No, it's Christopher Pine.
Yes, they've just changed. Yeah.
And these people, our politicians, are not scientifically or medically literate, and especially with global warming. They don't know what they're doing. They don't understand. And here we are in Queensland. And Palaszczuk, whatever her name is, wants to dig up coal all over the place. Coal in the Paris Accords is not counted, only per capita release.
So many cans of worms you're opening up here, Helen.
Well, I mean, are we going to survive, and what are we going to do with these politicians? Because we are a democracy, they are our representatives, and we are their leaders, and we don't use the democracy. We have to educate them and say, if you don't do this, you won't get elected next time. But we don't. We sit back, we're comfortable, we practice manic denial, we're into clothes and gourmet food or psychic numbing. But our kids know, don't they, Emma? Have you got kids?
I do.
Do they know about global warming and what's happening to the planet? No?
They know they love nature.
How old are they?
6 and 8.
Yeah, they're a little bit young.
You're with Emma Griffiths on ABC Radio Brisbane.
And it's 23 minutes to 11 on Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane. And you're listening to Dr. Helen Caldicott and Elizabeth Tynan, who had this conversation at the Brisbane Writers Festival about a week ago. And, it's brought in everything, hasn't it, really? A bit of sex. Lots of politicians. Not one to suffer fools lightly. I don't think anybody in this room. So if you're listening and you would like to share your opinion, the best way to do that is via text 0467 922 612.
If it's all up to us, Helen Caldicott, and I'll put this to you as well, Elizabeth Tynan, what can we do? If it is all up to us and there's nobody in a leadership position, what can we do?
Well, we have to educate ourselves, and it's no use arguing with anyone unless you have all the facts at your fingertips, right, Liz? So you can go to my website. I've written, 10 books, but if you read them, you'll know more than all politicians in Australia, let alone elsewhere. But do your research. You have to look in the mirror every morning and look at yourself and wonder what you're going to do today to save the planet. I can't stress how sacred life is.
There's a international movement. One of the essays in the book that you've edited, Sleepwalking to Armageddon, talks about the international movement to make nuclear weapons actually illegal through the United Nations. Yep. And so how far along is that cause?
It started by some people in the physicians movement that I created in Melbourne. They started it. And they've got 102 nations out of 187, I think, at the UN to sign it, but they need 50 to ratify it to make it law, to ban landmines and cluster bombs and chemical weapons. More and more are coming on. We haven't signed it, but we must.
50 nations. Well, are we going to make sure we do? It's up to us.
I think we should.
It's up to us. Yeah. It's not should. It's up to us to make sure our government, which represents us, signs that accord. They've got about nearly 10 nations now and they need 50. They're brilliant, these kids. They're brilliant. They go to the UN and they work with the ambassadors and go to various countries and they're doing it behind the scenes. It's like the curtain with the Wizard of Oz. And most of the world doesn't really know what's going on. But once that becomes law, then nuclear weapons are outlawed. This is clever. Yeah.
The problem is the big nuclear nations are not going to give them up.
Well, they're going to have to if it becomes international law. And it's more getting people to understand how a life is threatened. It's like the world's got cancer and the prognosis is grim.
I guess there is a precedent. Canada gave up its nuclear weapons.
So did South Africa.
That's right. So there are nations that have done this. Canada got nuclear weapons in the 60s and they gave them up in the 80s.
They had nuclear weapons.
Yeah, they didn't research them, they purchased them from the United States.
Did Trudeau get rid of them?
It was 1984 when they were got rid of, so that could have been Trudeau's.
Well, I had lunch with Pierre Trudeau. He was having an affair with Margot Kidder, who was Superwoman.
Yes.
And she took me to have lunch with him. She said, this is called whoring for peace. And he was such
a charming. Well, that's one way some of us could help, I guess.
Yes.
Charming man, the rose in the buttonhole. And, you know, I said, well, you know, you've got a democracy. Why don't you ban cruise missiles being tested in Canada by America? He said, if we had a democracy, everyone in Canada would have guns. And I thought, oh. So I thought, how am I going to crack this man? And so I finally talked to him about his boys, who he absolutely adored. And it cracked his psyche. And he started a 5-continent, 6-nation peace initiative and went around the world calling for nuclear disarmament.
Now, another essay in Sleepwalking to Armageddon talks about the fact that chemical weapons and landmines are illegal, that they are viewed as so evil that we do not permit them. And in fact, when they were used in Syria, both of the United States presidents that we've had in recent years have said that crosses the red line. So why is it, do you think, that chemical weapons and landmines are viewed as totally unacceptable, but we do have nuclear weapons?
There's a kind of nuclear psychosis embedded in the nuclear physicists and engineers. They're absolutely fascinated by it. And it's almost a masculine thing. And the weapons people in the Pentagon talk about missile erectors, soft laydowns.
Who knew that this conversation is going to be so much about
deep
sex?
Penetration, deep penetration, hard lines and soft lines. And they say we'll have a nuclear war like one big orgasmic thump. And they say this in front of women, with no sort of sense of embarrassment. So you've got to understand that there's a deep psychosis going on, and to split the atom is capturing the energy inside the sun. And we'll make your own conclusions, but I wrote that book, Missile Envy, and I wrote a lot about that. We have to get to the psychological dynamics behind what's going on. You can talk facts and facts and facts, but why? And where are the women? We're 52% of the population. We have oxytocin and progesterone and estrogen. We're the nurturers. We're smarter than men because our corpus callosum, which connects the right and left brain, is bigger in women than in men. So we're more in touch with our right brain intuition and our left brain. And where are we? We're pathetic. We're absolute wimps. And it's time we took over. We smacked their bottom, said, okay,
Helen, we've got a lot
Abbott,
to look
you're
after.
You know.
We're looking after a lot, though, Helen. We're bringing up children, working.
Well, we have to, it's part of bringing up
women,
your children
surely,
to make sure they have a future. We've got to take over.
Elizabeth, you mentioned you are delving into those very exciting party time worthy atomic top secret files now. Oh, yeah. Working on another book about tests that are that were very dangerous.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking at? Give us a teaser.
Okay. Well, I can't give away too much, only because it's not because I'm trying to be secret squirrel here, but I'm still in the early stages of researching. But I'm looking at the pre-Maralinga tests in particular. There are two other test sites that people perhaps have never heard of before. Even if they've heard of Maralinga, they might not have heard of Emu Field and Montebello Islands. Montebello Islands off the coast of Western Australia was the site of the very first British test in 1952, and then they returned there in 56. And you know what? They detonated the biggest atomic bomb in Australia from Montebello, but they lied to the Australian government about it. It was either 60 kilotons or 98, and we're not quite sure. Possibly 98.
Compared to the Hiroshima bomb, which was 13.
15, yeah, that's right. So at least four times the size of the Hiroshima, and possibly quite a bit more than that. So Montebello is very interesting, and that might be down the track a bit for me in my research, but I'm very interested in Emu Field, which is extremely remote. It's 130 kilometres north of Maralinga. Why did the British go there in 1953? Why did they spend money on a site that they knew would never be developed into a permanent test site? And I just saw some of these documents in the archives over in the UK, why did they say we must keep Australian politicians away from this site? Why did they not have the Australian Safety Committee, which incidentally hadn't even been formed then? They conducted extremely secret tests at Emu Field. So I'm looking at Emu Field and trying to get to the bottom of that test series. There were two atomic weapons that were exploded there. One of them, and it was called the Totem series, one of them created what is known as the Black Mist. And some of you may have heard about this, or at least have heard about Yami Lester, who was an Indigenous boy who was exposed to the Black Mist. He was only about 12 at the time, but he was blinded over... He wasn't blinded instantly, but over a period of time, he was blinded. But a number of other Indigenous people became extremely ill because of the Black Mist. I want to find out what that Black Mist was. And no one actually knows. It was dealt with in the Royal Commission rather inconclusively, and subsequent studies are rather inconclusive as well.
So is it not something that's generally associated with other nuclear tests?
It's unique to that test. There was something about Totem 1 that we don't know about. Now, those are the files that I keep coming up against roadblocks with, all the files to do with Totem. The Ministry of Defence is extremely interested in those files, and one that I found when I was in England earlier this year, it looked like a really juicy file. It had good Totem stuff in it, and I was going through, and then I'd just get to the juicy stuff, and there would be a cardboard insert saying, this section has been removed by the Ministry of Defence in 1993. Now, why were they looking at it in 1993 when the test took place in 1953? So why? What is it? And that was well past the time of the Royal Commission as well. So I want to find out why they're still covering up Totem. So Totem is my next... That's where I'm my head's at the moment, is the pre-Maralinga stuff.
Well, best of luck with that. I hope you find the answers. We need to know the answers.
Oh, thank you.
Now, time for your questions. If you've been listening through this and you've got questions, you need to be the first one to put your hand up and ask a question rather than tell a story or give an anecdote. Who have we got there? The gentleman there in the blue shirt? If you could just say your name and perhaps who you'd like to hear from.
My name's Richard Healy. Question for Dr. Tyne, and it's sort of three questions, but I think they're closely linked. What's the basis on which the British refuse access to certain files? Like, what's the legal basis on which they're relying? How do they decide between release and retention? And how does that situation compare with the Australian records?
Very, very good questions. Thank you very much. I don't know is the answer to the first two. I don't think anyone does. It's Ministry of Defence. When it's national security, they can do anything they like. So the Ministry of Defence has carte blanche to retain files. It's well past the 30-year rule. As you would understand, in most democracies, records are released after 30 years. But in England, in Britain, that has been bypassed, and so they retain files for reasons unknown. Interestingly, the Australian records are very much easy to access. And so I've mind you, the Australians didn't possess all the same records that the British possessed, but I've never found a file that I haven't been able to access at the Australian Archives, and just putting in a plug for the Australian Archives are absolutely brilliant. It is actually a very good marker of a democracy that you can get access to records. So I certainly can in Australia. The only place I've had a problem is in Britain.
You can only get it in Australia after 30 years though, can't you?
Cabinet documents, and that's right, yes, exactly, 30
years.
Does
it cost anything to actually put in Freedom of Information requests in the UK?
The way that I'm doing it through the Archives, it doesn't cost anything. But it certainly can cost a lot if you do it independently, yes.
Another question up the back there, sir.
Hi. Dr. Caldicott, I once had the pleasure of listening to you on a phone-in radio program during the Bush administration in the US. It was really great. And there was a fake caller called, and then the caller after the fake caller said, "I know that voice. He's this guy in the Bush administration." So it was really a terrific experience for me as a young guy in the US. So what I wanted to ask you was what the challenges you currently see are happening in the record-keeping business that might cause problems in the future.
What sort of records?
Well, the kinds of records that you're using to go back and write books now from things 50 years ago. Because we'll hopefully keep on going. One day we might have to fight these fights sometime in the
future.
We've
got to stop fighting. We've got to stop fighting and killing each other. That's fundamental. Records, well, what worries me is these days with computers, most of the stuff is being recorded in computers, and that's not going to be accessed by historians in the future because we could lose all those. I mean, if you blow one bomb up in the in space, you can destroy six Western states, the United States, and lose all the electronic records, etc. So we won't be able to really access historical records, I think, from now on because we're using computers all the time. What do you think?
Oh, it's certainly a live issue among archivists that the hard copies don't exist anymore. And so, and I'm not, it's not my field, but I think that there are, you know, creative ways that they're trying to invent to retain the records. But I do wonder about that too. Yeah. I think that's a real risk.
But for the past, yes, I can access really anything I want at the moment if I want to write any more books. But I've just turned 80 and I thought, I think I've done enough.
You've done such a lot for so many years, that's true.
Who else has a question? I think we need a question from one of those estrogen-rich, oxytocin-rich women in the audience.
I've still got a bit left.
Yes. What's your name?
My name is Leith. Dr. Caldicott, I'd be interested in you explaining what happened recently in Hawaii and why that didn't escalate.
Yes, well, what happened was in Hawaii, on everyone's mobile phones, it said we're under nuclear attack and we've got 28 minutes left. And it was really for real. It came from the centre where these warnings come from. And people just, they didn't know what to do. Where were their kids? Where would they go and hide? Men were opening manholes and putting their children down the manholes. And after, I don't know, 28 minutes or so, it was sent out that this was a false alarm. And it was, I think, some technician that pressed the wrong button. But it gave a wonderful woman an insight of what it would be like. And she wrote an incredible article for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, if you want to look that up, about how close we came. And she extrapolated to where we are now. And it could happen to any of us at any minute, at any time. I just wanted to say one more thing about oxytocin and estrogen. Oxytocin is a nurturing hormone that you secrete when you lactate, but also it's secreted when women are under stress. And there was an experiment done in a lab where some altercation occurred and the men went into the room, their rooms, and slammed the door and fumed, and the women came in the next morning and made coffee and tried to fix things up. The oxytocin levels went way up and the testosterone levels went way up.
And if you give men testosterone by inhaling it, it makes them all soft and gentle and yummy. But also, a man came up to me after a lecture once and he said, I've got prostate cancer. He said, I had my first dose of estrogen today. He said, for the first time, I wanted to go shopping.
Wow, what did he buy? Okay, more questions. Yes.
In the terrible situation that you've talked about, that we're facing nuclear weapons going off, do you have any tips for survival? What can we do?
You can't survive. No. Well, you know, you can get into underground shelters. They had plans for this. There was a federal emergency management agency, and the plan was that if there's going to be a nuclear strike, odd numbers, number plates left that day and went to locations in Vermont, then the next day even numbers. But there was a man called T.K. Jones who's in charge of it, said if there are enough shovels to go around, we're all going to make it. And what you do is in the half an hour as the weapons are coming, you get your trusty shovel out, dig a hole 3 by 6 feet, get in the hole, you put two doors on top and the dirt on top, and he said it's the dirt that does it. And someone asked Senator Markey, who puts the dirt on top of the hole, and he said your mother-in-law does. And that was excerpted with enough shovels in the Playboy Mansion, where I gave an address with Paul Newman, who kissed my hand.
Of course he did.
And to all the film stars. And this girl came up and said, I think you're the only person on earth who can convince my father about this. And it was Patty Davis, who was Reagan's daughter.
Yes.
And she got, and I said, I'm not going to have anyone else there. I'll see him alone or not at all. And she rang the next day and said, we've got an hour at the end of his working day. And I said, what time is that? She said, 4 o'clock. And that's how I got to see Reagan, through Patty Davis. Yeah.
Wow.
What?
What a life, hey? I think we might make this the last question. Thank you very much.
Hi. Fascinating conversation. Thank you. I just wondered if either of you had any thoughts about nuclear power.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about nuclear power. I led the movement against the French tests, and Australians don't like the French, so there was a huge movement. They stopped buying French letters, not condoms, but and wine and stuff, and we forced the French to test underground. Whitlam did that. But then I heard Whitlam wanted to mine uranium, so I went to the Barth Smith Library at the University of Adelaide, got out a book called Poison Power, and I nearly lost all my hair on the desk. I mean, I'd never read anything so dangerous in my medical life. And so I started a movement against nuclear power. I had a friend who was an engine driver, and he got me to speak to the unions all over Australia. And the way I did it was I'd at the Trades and Labour Council in Adelaide, and I was premenopausal, so I looked all right. And I had 10 minutes to talk. Be factual. 10 minutes to talk, and the guys were very lubricated and talked. They talked a lot while I was talking. I thought, oh my God, what am I going to? So, halfway through, I started talking about the medical effects of radiation upon their testicles, and you could have heard a pin drop. And at the end of that, they said, oh, I don't want my kids growing up. So the ACTU, Australian Council of Trade Unions, passed a resolution to neither mine, transport nor export uranium, and it lasted for 3 or 5 years till Hawke got in and brought in the three mine policy, which is like, you're just a little bit pregnant, but don't worry about it. You're only a tiny bit pregnant, you know, that sort of thing. And then last time I saw Whitlam was at the University of Sydney, and he was sitting there, he's really old, and he said, you still into uranium? And I said, yes. And so when I stood up to give my talk, I said, we're in the presence of the greatest Prime Minister Australia's ever had. And he loved it. But he was still into uranium mining without understanding the medical scientific consequences of that. And nuclear power is creating hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive waste, which must be stored, isolated from the ecosphere for 1 million years, according to the American EPA. They don't know where to put it. So the age of nuclear waste has begun. It will produce epidemics of cancer, leukemia, genetic disease, and congenital anomalies for the rest of time. Random compulsory genetic engineering as it leaks into the water supply, bioconcentrates in the food chains.
Emma Griffiths. Focus on ABC Radio Brisbane.
Nuclear weapons. And that was Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's been an activist fighting against nuclear weapons and technology since at least 1971. And Elizabeth Tynan, who's an associate professor at James Cook University, whose book Atomic Thunder, The Maralinga Story, has won awards for what she's uncovered about Australian history. It was a fascinating discussion. Who would have thought that it would go to sex and hormones and women and men and gender issues? But there we went. If you missed any of that, it'll be up on our website shortly. I'll be back with you tomorrow with another episode of Focus.
In fires, floods, storms, heat waves, or power outages, turn to a source you can trust to keep you and your family safe. ABC Radio. On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app.